Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker. And today I have Gail Nicolaysen Shurtleff, and she is a psychologist. She has a clinical psychology degree from John F. Kennedy University, and she has a private practice and is currently living in the Netherlands, so that's an interesting thing we might be able to get to talk about a little bit. But my main reason for having her on is that she listened to my Carol Boyer interview on disabilities and just had some really good feedback about how we could continue to explore that discussion. And I really am very grateful when people are willing to do that and, you know, give comments. And so I invited her on, and here she is. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Natasha.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on. So I think, you know, just firstly, is I'd like for you to give us a little bit more of an introduction of yourself than I just did, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a psychologist. And I know you're also a member of the church, so maybe give us a little bit of your Mormon history as well.
Okay. Let's start with the church. I'm a lifer. I was raised in...
What is a lifer?
A lifer. I was born into the church.
Okay. That's fun when I hear a new term.
Life sentence. yes, I have a warped humor. I was born and raised in the church. Our family was very well known in the area where we lived, and I've had some experiences such as when I was very young. My father was a mission president in the Andes mission in Peru. So I started my living out of the country rather early.
How old were you when you?
We went down when I was three.
Oh, wow.
And returned. And we were actually the first family that served a three-year mission under President McKay. So we were, when we were called, we went not knowing when we would return. It could have been 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. We didn't know. It was an indefinite calling. So that's how old I am, and that's how long ago it was. And I need to mention that because part of my story and part of how I look at disability also comes from the fact that I had, in a sense, been raised in a house in the church that was kind of privileged. We knew people, and it made a difference in how I was treated versus how somebody else was treated. And I came to my further beliefs in the church through reading, just listening to a lot of people, and my husband's own faith crisis started me examining what I really felt more. So as far as the church it goes now, I'm kind of a non-traditional member. And a little more radical, outspoken. Either of those words would fit. My disability,
I was born with cataracts, which were operated on when I was a year old. They discovered that I had a hearing loss when I was about seven, and I also had a speech loss, and so they were having to teach me to talk. And we were fortunate to be in Lima when I was in need of speech therapy, and I was able to get speech therapy from this really great British trained therapist.
And at the time, they were just the leading people in the world. And so I got really good speech therapy and came out speaking really well with no residual problems. So I was very fortunate that way. I feel very thankful that we wound up in Peru and that I could get what I needed. Like I said, I was born blind, had the surgery, and have lived in as a low vision sighted person ever since then. And the hearing loss was not really something I dealt with until a few years ago. But it is a part of my life and I do deal with it. I came to being a psychologist because I had some mentors in high school there in the States that saw that I had a gift for figuring this stuff out and really looking at puzzles with people. And they encouraged me. And I took my own life journey to the work I'm doing now. Received my degree when I was in my mid-30s and opened up a practice in the Bay Area and met my husband in 1994. And we were together for 4 years and he got an assignment to come over here to Germany. And we decided, well, we've been going out and why don't we take a little break and see if we want to continue this? And at the end of the fall, he was offered a contract in Germany and we decided to get married. So I shut down my practice in the States and came to Europe and the rest is history. I'm working here now.
Okay. All right. That's wonderful. Okay. So just a few questions from what you brought up. I mean, you mentioned, growing up in this very active family, obviously, in the church.
Yes.
And well-known family because, to get to the point of a mission president, obviously you're somewhat connected with leadership and things of that nature.
Correct.
So you mentioned being treated differently than maybe other disabled people within the church system. Can you expound on that and when maybe you started recognizing that?
Well, the difference only lasted so long because children grow up and parents of children, how can I put this? Parents of children allow their kids to do what they want. At first, I believed that I was treated different because of who my father was. So I was shielded from bullying, but eventually that changed. When I became a teenager, that definitely changed. I was singled out by the adolescents in the ward because of the disabilities, the differences, and it was not only in church, but they took it over into our high school and made it difficult for me there as well. And it was a challenge.
So you went to school with many of the people in your ward?
Yes. Our neighborhood was basically Mormon, Catholic, and Jewish. So it was an interesting combination. The part of town we lived in was rather well off. So it made a difference, and it made a difference with the church people. And there were probably, two wards and about 50 LDS kids there.
Okay. So it was a rather large group.
And this bullying, I mean, would you, how do you separate that from Mormonism, or is that even possible? Do you think that that would have happened in any type of religious kind of community or community in general, especially the time frame that you're talking about, when I think obviously bullying wasn't something that was really talked about a lot at that time?
Good question.
How can I? Let me explain this by explaining the doctrine of specialness.
Mormons
have this warped sense of disability where, for instance, if you have one, somehow you are more choice or chosen than other people. You don't have to deal with certain things in your life. For instance, a person who is developmentally disabled is so much more choice and precious than the person without that disability. And obviously, they don't need to have all their mental faculties. It can get that screwed up.
Right. And this carries over to things like, they're not expected to attend the temple or get baptized even, or things of that nature happen.
Oh, in our rituals, no, correct? It's even more convoluted than that.
Mm-hmm. They supposedly they're not expected to attend the temple, be ordained. And this is where it gets really twisted. There are developmentally people, and I am aware of them having worked in this area, who have attended the temple, who are ordained, and it's done more for social reasons than anything else.
Right. In other words, we don't want to have them feel left out, or like, I know, like, especially along autism spectrum, mm-hmm. there's quite a bit of range of capability, right, that people can have.
Yeah. And so why members of the church
members of the church have issues with disability that they don't realize they have. And they bully and exclude, and yet at the same time send a message that says, oh, but we're going to ordain you as a deacon because we need to have the appearance of everything being okay socially. Deal with that as a parent. If you're the mother of an autistic, and your bishop comes to you and says, well, Sister Jones, we know that Kyle here is going to be 12 next month, and we think that we should move him on out of primary and into the deacon's quorum. But Kyle, while he might be able to sit still, cannot understand what he's getting involved in. And yet the bishop still wants to ordain him. And you as a mother or a father are put in the position of saying, wait a minute, no, this is not good. I don't want this. It's a social ordination. You know, you're put in a situation as a parent. Or now what do?
It makes addressing the disability of your young child difficult. So there's an issue of privilege. There's an issue of wanting to protect your child from what they can't understand.
And an issue in the ward of expectation that we're going to, in a sense, keep the status quo normal and pass Kyle on. Makes it hard for parents.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, I've been aware of family situations where it kind of can go both ways, like where, you know, there's, I know, for example, of a daughter in a ward I was in one time, and she was, you know, on the autistic spectrum, like I said, but quite highly functional. And she, it was just kind of one of those sad situations where she's, you know, just very aware of her difference, you know, so aware enough that of her difference. And she desperately wanted to go to the temple. And, you know, I was aware of the discussion happening that there was no need for her to go to the temple, right? Because she was, like you're saying, this kind of special person that was not in the need of that. And over a course of about 6 to 9 months, she eventually did go to the temple. And then there's other situations like what you're saying, where those kinds of rituals are pushed upon the child or the young adult or whoever it is.
Right.
And they're not ready, you know, and then it feels right. More like this expectation that's placed on parents or the system to, you know, oh yeah, we're going to make them feel included. We're going to help them, you know, move along like all the other kids. And in a sense, they're being left behind while we do that. So it's kind of this complicated mixture, right? For some people, it's good to participate in those things. And for some others, it may not be. And we're all unqualified in wards usually as to, like, we're not mental health professionals usually in these wards, you know, where we're making right. these types of decisions. So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that. And then I'd also like for you to go back and talk a little bit about why you feel like this specialness that you mentioned. I'm kind of doing my quote-unquote
yes.
you know, signs. What's convoluted about that? Because I think a lot of people would look at that as, oh, that's a beautiful way to deal with the maybe grief or sadness about having a disability in your family. But I completely understand where you're coming from, so I want you to expound on that.
I'm going to use an example of somebody I worked with to talk about the specialness. This is what's wrong with that, and this is why thinking in terms of specialness is so destructive to everyone involved. I worked in a developmentally disabled program in Utah. I won't state where, to protect people that could still be out there dealing with it in the process. I was dealing with an adult male, and we had him on a behavior modification program. And we needed to work with him to change his behavior to be more socially acceptable. Well, in the process of working with him, one day I was actually engaged with him, and he was tantruming. And I stopped him and I said, we'll call him Artie. I said, Artie, you're capable of stopping this. If you don't stop screaming at me right now, you're going to wind up with a chip. And he looked at me and he said, you can't do that to me. I'm special. About that angry. And I thought, what? And I thought about it for a moment, and he said it again. And I stopped him. I said, what do you mean? He says, you can't punish me. I'm special. And I said, so your parents have told you that you're special? He said, yes. I don't have to be punished. I'm innocent. I'm special. How am I supposed to deal with that as an employee who's trying to get somebody to change their behavior when they're intelligent enough to understand that what they've been told is that they're innocent and they are beyond punishment. Behavior mod doesn't work. You have to step back. And I thought at that point, this is why being special rubs me the wrong way. Parents tend to tell their children they're special to exclude themselves from the responsibility of parenting somebody appropriately. Are you seeing what I'm saying here?
Yeah, and I think the other facet that I see to it as well, especially let's say at the birth or the realization that something is awry, there's little room to grieve with this type of
Right. Of
framework, because it's like, oh, well, you know, it's okay, honey. You have been chosen to parent this special child and be grateful that you have this amazing spirit that's come into your life. And that completely, yeah. I mean, although I understand that that's a beautiful kind of framework in a sense that we do see, disability as something that is not necessarily, you know, ugly or awful in that sense, but at the same time, it minimizes or ignores the tremendous amount of work and lifestyle change that a disabled child will bring into the family's life. And oftentimes I hear, you know, mothers and fathers saying, well, I don't want to be special. You know, I didn't ask for a special child.
Right.
You know, and so... And so that it almost and has this guilt associated with it, you know, like I'm supposed to be happy about this thing that really has caused a tremendous amount of extra work and extra stress and grief and, you know, unmet expectations and just all the things that come along with raising, I think, a disabled child, which is a huge challenge.
Yes. And I will go back to my own birth here and state that, my mother took me into the doctor 6 weeks after I was born because they realized that, you know, there were definitely things wrong. And after she got the news, my father was off working. And so she heard this alone, which is traumatic in itself. But I give the doctor credit for doing something. The doctor really sat down with her and said, this wasn't your fault. You know, I will have to date myself by saying, I was born the way I was because of the pandemic in 1958, the rubella pandemic. And my mother had such a light case of it, they didn't even know if it was going to do any damage to her baby. So my mother heard the words from the doctor, and the doctor sat with her while she really processed what had happened and was able to come back to the fact that nature just really did something terrible. And it wasn't anything other than nature. And consequently, she had a different attitude from different women and other parents in wards we were in as I was older regarding her disabled, she wound up having two disabled children. My younger sister died at age 14 of cardiac problems, but she wound up with a different attitude. We weren't special. We just happened to be kids with disabilities, and she had to deal with us that way. Consequently, there was no differentiation of discipline within the home. My older brother and sister got in trouble the same way I got in trouble. I was disciplined in the same manner they were. And in some homes, that can even be an issue.
How you discipline the disabled child is different. And if
if you are a family where you have a special spirit, a child with special needs, it can change that dynamic. And thus, it can come out within the framework of the church as well.
Well, this even reminds me of the possibility of how we frame our relationship with God himself, and in the sense of, is this something, you know, like you're saying, your mother saw it as maybe nature, part of this mortal existence. You know, I can see her thinking of it that way in her Mormon framework. But many will see it as, well, you know, this is something that God purposefully did, you know, in the sense of.
Well, that certainly is going to enslave the mind.
Yeah,
if so God purposely gives you a disabled child, ultimately, what kind of a God are you dealing with? You know, I mean, think about it in those terms. So God zapped me blind and hearing impaired, and I had to go through surgery to get some vision. And this is what a loving God would do?
Yeah.
That's going to put you in psychotherapy for a long time.
Well, and I think, unfortunately, mess with your relationship with deity if you so choose to believe in deity. And I think that it's just this convoluted kind of discussion that I see happening, not just in Mormonism, but in religion altogether, just how we make sense of what we call trials, right? So are trials part of a nice little package that was built just for us, you know, and God hands us our nice little package of trials, which can include things like you're saying, disability or rape or all kinds of things that are horrific, you know, that happen in people's lives. Or do we see it more as a consequence of the mortality we are in, and, you know, God is more of the comforter that helps us in those times of need, or, you know, through those things. So that's a very kind of touchy, weird thing that I think I hear messages kind of on both sides of that equation constantly, you know, especially at church, how people talk about their trials and how they try to make sense of these things that go awry in their lives.
And it is solely that. How do I make sense of this? Well, you can either choose to stand up and take responsibility for it and say, I make sense of it by dealing with it head on, or I choose to camouflage it. And I think what gets members into trouble, and religious people in general, is a lot of times they tend to camouflage it by saying special, you don't need to experience this. I'm having trouble completely thinking here. What they say, I guess what they do is really a disservice to the disabled as a whole. In thinking that way, it gives them an out, and the disabled person is not able to reach their full potential
because of the way they're viewed.
Well, and historically, you know, when I think about disabilities, you know, it's kind of interesting, at least I perceive it as a pendulum shift. You can tell me if you agree or not with this, but, you know, let's say 1,000 years ago or whenever we hear kind of these horrific stories of people who are disabled being treated like really outcast to the point that they're killed or sent away in some type of institution, or even seen through the lens of, you know, you have a demon inside of you, and, you know, a lot of it was religious persecution even, you know, just seen through the lens of sin and that type of lens. And so I kind of see the pendulum having shift way too far onto the other side, which tends to happen with pendulums, you know. And,
yes.
And so now, you know, realizing that that was such a convoluted way to look at disabled, we've kind of come full circle to this idea of specialness, like you're saying, and let's revere them, but it's still treating them as different.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, hopefully we're in this time frame where we can start to normalize this pendulum and not having to be on such extremes. And what I'd like to kind of get into next is, how do we do that? You know, what insights do you have for us as a culture and as a people and in our ward communities, as far as how do we start approaching these issues on a more healthy level for all involved?
Okay, that's a great topic. And I'm actually looking at some ideas I wrote down before we, you know, talk today. Let me go through a few of them. Disabled people do not need to be made whole. As a disabled person, I view myself as whole how I am now, with my visual impairment, with my hearing impairment, with the fact that I have to use devices to help me hear better, with the fact that I use devices to help me function on the computer better. I have a white cane that I use when I'm out walking. I don't want to be fixed. That's one of the first rules of this game. Another rule is that within the church, I think that we might tend to think that we can bless the disability away. If we apply enough priesthood, we can heal this person. And that's part of the same, that's another area of making the disabled person whole. We have to, as church members, accept that difference exists, and difference and variety are the spice of life. Just as if I may be straight, my sister sitting in the pew ahead of me might be gay. We're all different. And it's that difference that enables us to heal, if you want to look at it in that sense. Heal from a misunderstanding. Not from the disability, from misunderstanding who we each are. And I don't need to be fixed to be made whole.
Well, and I'm so glad you said that, because this causes a lot of pain even amongst those who are providing the blessings. And I think for parents in particular, it's kind of it. And not that it's always said completely up front, although there have been times I've seen it said. But it's this idea of, you, as you know, so let's say the mother, for example, now sees her husband as flawed because somehow he didn't have enough faith to heal their child, right? And so now this creates this kind of wall or divide between them that may be spoken or unspoken, but it's there. And even within, I think, a priesthood member's self-esteem, you know, just there must have been something wrong, or I must have been flawed in some way. Because, you know, if I just had the faith of a mustard seed, which is so small, this is what we hear, right? That I should have been able to fix this. And so I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that can be really harmful to relationships and even just to people's self-identity as a faithful person.
You know, the other thing that happened, ironically enough, when I was 6 weeks old was I was blessed. They did the, you know, blessing in the church. And I didn't know what that blessing said until my father and I had a discussion when I was around 16. And he shared with me, he said that I blessed you. And he said, I really asked for what to say because I didn't want to say something that was wrong. I really needed help. I didn't know what to bless you with. And he said, what he was told to say was, you will have the experience of a healthy sighted woman. And he stated that when he said that, he didn't even know if I would be given sight. He didn't know if the surgery that I would go through when I was one and supposedly older would work. Because one of the problems with cataract surgery is that it can leave a lot of scarring and it can't be successful in the way that mine turned out to be successful. But the fact that he blessed me with normal experience, but not knowing what that would be, whether I would remain blind all my life or whether I would be given vision, was really important for me to know. And it let me know also that he was okay with whatever happened. And that there weren't going to be these expectations of healing in some miraculous way. And I think that a lot of members have those feelings that because of the priesthood, the man should be able to heal. And it does trap men into a very guilt-ridden situation. You know, am I not righteous enough? Did I not say the right thing when I gave this blessing to my child? What have I done? What didn't I do? How can I fix this? How can I make this whole? And then the resentment can start to build.
Yeah, I agree. And I think blessings are a wonderful ritual that we have in our culture. But I do agree that oftentimes the expectations we put on those are can be problematic.
Yes.
And so, thank you. Okay, so what else do you have on your list?
What else?
Let's see, what else do I have on my list? Okay, let's talk about women, body image, young women who are disabled, I think have even more of a burden than healthy young women who are not disabled. And by this I mean that I can speak to this through the deaf, the hearing the visually impaired, sitting in a young women's class, being told, you're going to be a wife. You're going to be a mother. The reality within the church is that that gets taught. The reality within the world is that how the disabled are perceived as somewhat defective can cause for them not to have the same social experiences others have. And so a young woman who happens to be disabled, maybe she's in a wheelchair, maybe she is deaf, she may not be viewed the same way as a healthy, able-bodied young woman who might feel more hope towards becoming a wife and a mother. I can tell you from experience that you are looked at differently, both in the church and out of the church. Not so much out of the church anymore. I've had better experiences out of the church, and while I'm married to an LDS man, I was fortunate that I found one that didn't run away. So it is an issue how we teach young women in the church about body image and who they are is an issue, especially for the disabled who already has one level of distorted, in many cases, body image to deal with. Why she might not move properly, she might not look the same as other women. When it gets to the instinctual, just instinct, sexuality, she's not going to deal with it the same way. I'm going to use a brutal example because that's the best one I know, and it's from my life. I attended Rick's when it was Rick's, and I did not date in the same way that other women dated. But one night, I got this phone call, and there was a guy in the ward I was in who happened to be blind, and I did not know this. But one of the other guys in the ward thought it would be, well, several of the guys thought it would be really funny to set me up on a date with this guy who was blind. Ha ha ha, blind date. And it was for a dance, and I was totally unprepared for the fact that he was blind, completely. He did not know anything about me other than my name. And this, it was as if the savages had put these two people in a ring and said, hey, let's see how we can mess with them. And it was hard on both of us, but I think harder on me than on him, because he had some sense of knowing what was coming and I didn't. And it was as if, let's put you in the ring. This is who you are going to date. And it just stunned me. And after that, you know, I dealt with it as best I could as an 18-year-old woman who had, you know, was getting her out of the home feet. And I just went home and cried. And I thought, is that how they view me? Do they view me as this object that can be mistreated like this? And then I stepped back and I started looking at what was really going on there. That, in a sense, I'm glad I had the experience, because it made me see that this was really just a meat market. It didn't have anything to do with healthy social mores. It didn't have anything to do with acceptance. I was viewed different, and it made me think, I'm being viewed totally differently than somebody who does not have a visual impairment, because that was the most visual thing, was the vision. And I thought, wow, if this is how dating is supposed to occur within the church. And if this is how people think about it in these terms, that this savage, I don't think I want this. And I did, while I did graduate from Rick's, that was a turning point for me. If that was how LDS people were thinking about the disabled, and if that's how they treated the disabled, that was something that really needed to be rethought. And so at that point, I started to think about sexuality different, and I understood that given that that's what was going on with LDS men and women and sexuality, that most disabled people within the church would never have a chance at obtaining a healthy marriage. Maybe that's a leap, but the fact of the matter is that that's what I was seeing. And it was stunning and horrible and painful and sad. And what are we raising within the church? What I realized was we were raising people who had a very unhealthy attitude towards humanity.
Well, and to your point, it doesn't take much in our culture to become undesirable as a potential spouse, right? I mean, we have even, let's forget disability. I mean, if you're not a return missionary, if you're I remember even in Young Women's that we'd come up with these lists of the types of qualities we would want in another person. Yeah. I mean, it is very much about, you know, finding somebody who is righteous and who is, you know, in a sense, like your best statistical bet to take you to the temple and have children with and kind of follow this Mormon lifestyle timeline that we very much, I think, teach in our culture. And so I think that there's already this kind of very difficult sense of perfection almost that young single adults talk about, feeling this pressure that they have to meet certain mold and be a certain type of person to be considered a desirable partner within Mormon culture. And that's very just very stressful. So imagine on top of that, you know, having some sort of disability where it even furthers that type of sense of undesirability. And I think that's exactly what you're describing, is this sense of if you can't already be desirable as a healthy person because of something to do with your belief system, how are you ever going to be desirable? If on top of it you have some type of physical malady or intellectual malady or some type of issue in that regard.
Which puts you back into the situation of, so let's justify all of this by just saying this person is special. It's circular. If we as church members really want to make this better, we need to wipe special from our vocabulary, no matter what the disability. We need to wipe that out completely. Until we do that, we are not in any position to move forward with this issue. It just won't happen.
Yeah, and I think that we've also been quite focused on probably, visual disabilities, things that people can kind of tell, but I mean, there's a whole slew of mental health disabilities as well, right, that aren't even on the radar screen when people are getting to know each other sometimes. And so it does become a really complex, I guess, territory to try to venture.
You know, I just had a thought. Do we call a schizophrenic a special person? A person with a child who's diagnosed, let's say 7 or 8 years old with schizophrenic, would we call them a special person? No. To call them a special person would demean who they are. Why are we calling developmentally disabled people special? Why are we calling the person with paralysis special? I notice this kind of stuns you when I say this, but that's what this is really about. It is about how do we think about the human being? How do we make it okay for us to either accept or not accept the difference? Ultimately, it's about diversity, but it's about making some diversity more safe than others. So we would never tell a parent with a child who has a schizophrenic, oh, you're so blessed. Because one, it would be offensive. And two, schizophrenia is not a blessing. Why are we doing that with anything else?
Yeah, so that kind of came back right around to your first point of kind of the language that we're using and how we're framing some of these issues within our culture.
You know, back to young women's is the way in which young women are not talked about, for instance, not taught about sexuality. The lack of healthy teaching in the church is even more damaging to disabled young women who may have dysfunctional body images than the young women who are struggling just with an unhealthy body image due to the fact that the church, and I'm going to be very blunt here, church views women as chattel. That's the bottom line. And how are you supposed to teach a healthy young woman, let alone a woman with a disability who has that added issue attached to herself? How are you supposed to teach them that they are a healthy, capable, successful, functioning woman, and that they can have a healthy sexual image of themselves? It's even worse.
Can you back up a little bit and saying that the church views women as chattels, obviously a strong language.
Yeah, and, I warned you.
Right. No, and so that's fine. I'd like to understand a little bit where you're coming from on that. Because again, I know that people are listening, you know, on all sides of the spectrum on Mormonism programs and
meditation. But
at the same time, I think that there's something behind what you're saying that is something we need to be looking at.
Yes, I think so too. I think I'm being that strong to actually provoke in this case. Because just saying that women, there is such, you know, women are told you are to be a wife, you are to be a mother. And that reduces the woman to being a wife and being a mother. That's a polite way of putting it. That tells her that beyond that, she is not capable and not desired to be doing anything else. You know, one of the things that enabled me to survive in this man's church was the fact that I knew I was intelligent. I knew I could get an education. I knew I had to, because I was disabled, and the chances of me having that stay-at-home fantasy were very slim. I had to get past looking at myself as a wife and a mother. I absolutely had to. But that's what the church teaches, whether you want to accept it or not. It doesn't go beyond that. And when that's what you teach, what a woman believes about her body and who she is and what she is capable of doing is very limited.
Both of them are indirectly tied to sexuality anyway.
Right.
Because if a wife, you're going to be having sex, and a yes. mother, you're going to be having, you know, pregnancy and childbirth. And there's so many complications even with just those physicalities for so many people, you know, even
right.
without necessarily entering into the realm of disability. And so
right.
I think your point is that if we're limiting our roles in such a rigid way, then it really kind of doesn't help women expound on their entirety of self and their individuality, and they may very well choose to become mothers and wives, and there's nothing obviously wrong with that, but their
right.
experience is so much grander than just those two roles.
It also... And here's where it gets really tricky, is it also places the woman in and the disabled woman in a place where she is even more likely to become abused, either sexually or physically and emotionally. That narrow gap, that narrow teaching, gives her very little option.
Yeah, can you please now, expound on that? Because the statistics on that are sobering. I mean, it's
oh,
very,
yeah.
very upsetting, the statistics around this particular issue that you're bringing up right now.
Right. So, you know, the teaching, you know, I personally have a great issue with teaching women that their role is to be a wife and a mother, because it damns disabled women to a very scary future. If that's the only choice they have, and yet Darwin tells us that humanity needs to procreate for its own reasons, but we search out genetic, not perfection, but people with a good enough genetic makeup to where they're desirable. If we know from the genetic standpoint that we have to choose people, partners who can give us a great genetic result with our offspring, we want to go there. But when we teach in the church that we are commanded to procreate, and yet there is, in a sense, a part of society that is viewed as genetically inferior because they have disabilities, it puts the person in that position who is LDS in a really difficult situation. Technically, they cannot fulfill the commandment because they are not going to be sought out. And this, in turn, brings on a whole new list of issues. Depression, unworthiness. Somehow, all of a sudden, you're not desirable goods And that goes back to looking at how we teach women in the church about self-worth, sexuality, and being worthwhile. If I would not have had the instinct to know that I had to prepare for a career long before a lot of other peers, I would have been in a far worse place. This is why teaching young women what is taught now about being a wife and a mother is so detrimental. We trap even the healthy young women because not everybody's going to be selected. Not everybody is going to find a spouse, a partner. It's damning.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a very limited viewpoint on self, and ignores so many of the individual facets of every individual. There's no reason why we couldn't do a better job of balancing that out. It's not that family isn't important or that we can't prepare people for family life, you know, within a church setting, but it just seems like the teachings are so unbalanced. You know, there's like 99% of that being taught versus 1%, right, of the more individual kind of goals and things of that nature. So
right. Okay.
All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, I was thinking,
even ironically enough, for those who do actually believe in polygamy, I don't. The disabled woman does not even win in polygamy because she still can't multiply and create and necessarily be desirable to raise healthy children.
I think what you're getting at, even though polygamy is obviously not a part of our mainstream behavioral teachings at this point, there's a lot of current talk about polygamy with some of the essays that have come out recently, and there are Mormons, well, not necessarily part of our mainstream, and I think your point is that oftentimes, even in that structure, a disabled woman would be possibly seen as less than or pitied, almost like, well, we'll
correct.
We'll take her. And I think that's a lot of the current talk around polygamy anyway, is a big reason why polygamy was needed, although I believe this is somewhat of a myth, but how we talk about it currently is that women needed to be taken care of. Right. And so possibly they were widowed or they were whatever it was, but this would definitely fit the mold for disabled women, you know, from this type of perspective, is that she's not being chosen necessarily for her sexual, sensual, complicated, beautiful self. She's being chosen because we need to take care of her and therefore pitied.
Correct. That's exactly it. And that's the bottom line, is that there is an underlying culture in the church of pitying the disabled.
And I will restate what I stated earlier. Disabled people don't want to be pitied, and they want to be viewed as whole. They don't need to be pitied. The majority of disabled people are very capable of holding down some kind of a job, even if it's a part-time job. They're capable of taking care of themselves on some level. Some may need help, but the majority of disabled people can be out in the world functioning. They don't need your pity. They might need assistance, but not pity. And there's a difference. Assistance, meaning that they might need transportation. They might need help up a stairs at some time, or holding a door open as a convenience. But most of the time, even that is minimal.
Yeah. So let's, I want to get back to your list so that we can kind of go through some of the Mormon-esque things. And then I'd like to go towards the kind of back to the Carol Boyer interview of some of the resources that she was putting forth and some of the challenges that you've had experience with as far as reaching through some of those resources. And so kind of like the Mormon world, but then also kind of the greater world as well.
I've known some disabled men that have not been ordained as deacons, and I've known others that have. I've known one that has actually had the ability to understand what was going on. He was actually, when I met him, it was the brother of a friend, and he was actually a Melchizedek priesthood holder. And he understood what was going on. He was probably in the high 80s IQ-wise. And he got it. And he was not a product of social ordination. However, most of these young deacons are. And they don't really understand what's going on. I find, you know, I'm finding problems with that, because if we say the priesthood actually means something, and if we say that it's valid, why are we doing this to a young 12-year-old or 14 or 16-year-old who can't understand the meaning of it? And I look at that in with the issue in mind that here we have women who deeply desire to be ordained and who understand and know what it is. And they are being told with full faculty, with their full faculties, that no, you can't have even what this young boy at 12 who doesn't understand it, but who has been ordained for social reason. You can't have that. So for me, this is more of a hot political issue, but it's one that we really need to be looking at and questioning from, should we really be ordaining these young men socially when, in all due respect, they are not deserving? Maybe that's harsh, but I believe that it's an issue that needs to be looked at.
And just to clarify, I think you're not speaking of the young men who, like you said, have some intellectual capacity and want to be involved and want to, you know, as they see it, be partakers of what other young men in their same age group are being partakers of.
Right.
Because in that exactly. sense, in that sense, they may not be fully understanding to the level of like a mature, older person, right, who has a much deeper understanding of the priesthood, but they are able to understand sufficient that they want to be involved and you know, it kind of comes out of this goodwill place. But I think what you're discussing more is when intellectual capacity is so lessened that there's really no ability to how do I want to say? I guess just to be able to engage in that process.
Right. To learn. What I'm talking about is learning. But in a sense, when you look at it, and when you look at a healthy, let's say a healthy 12-year-old boy, he has the ability to learn and understand, but he may not really fully comprehend what he's getting into. I don't think most healthy 12-year-old boys do. But they have the ability to learn that. And we are talking about, you know, a child might have the ability to learn some, as you've said, on a limited basis, but they may never progress beyond, let's say, a 12-year-old learning. What kind of position are we putting them in?
Right. Okay. So coming kind of towards the end then of some of these Mormon things, is there anything else that you're wanting to bring up? I mean, I think
let's see here.
Mostly what you're bringing up, I think, are huge issues of discussion that need to be happening.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And, you know, if I have done that, if I have been able to open the door so that we can discuss this stuff in honesty and with a more full understanding and to boldly go where no man or woman has gone before on this subject, I'm happy. Yeah. I think as far as the world, you know, outside the church, you know, I deal with a lot of LinkedIn sites for professionals with disabilities. And there is a great deal of frustration with the government and how the bureaucracies work. And I think that in all honesty, I would have to say, knowing what I know now, if I was to counsel parents who are coming to see me because they had a child with a disability, one of the things I would counsel them to do is to learn how to be your best advocate and to talk to a lot of people, adult disabled people, who are attempting to find employment right now and find out what they are looking at as issues so that you can start to work with your child and prepare them, because you've got to start preparing your kid even pre-kindergarten for what they're going to be expecting as a 16-year-old child who is starting to look at getting training for a career. Because it's a nasty world out there for the disabled. Employers aren't friendly to us still. No matter how much help we have from the government in trying to make it better for us, the ADA did not solve all of our problems, unfortunately. And we're still left struggling with it.
Yeah, that was, I think, one of your main critiques of the interview I did with Carol Boyer, is that it almost sounded too easy to get part of these, you know, to get tapped into some of these resources. And I know that working with families where this has been an issue, it is extremely difficult. And there's just a lot of, well, first of all, just like you're saying, the bureaucracy, the paperwork, the finding the right resources, and then the time involved in, you know, getting those things in place. And so, yeah, if you could speak a little bit more to some of the challenges that you see, that would be helpful, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Here's a big one. And this is one that actually church members could help the disabled with. I talked with my sister. My sister is also blind. We have a genetic disease in our family, and it caused her to go blindness, or to go blind. And here's her take on this. If she has to go to the Department of Rehabilitation for some kind of services, she lives in Modesto in California. It takes her an hour from her home to get there. But the bus drops her off close to the place. But it also takes her an hour to get back. If somebody picks her up with a car, it takes her 15 minutes to get there and 15 minutes to get back. She's a busy woman. Trust me. If she wants services from the Department of Rehabilitation, it might take her 6 months to get them. And then she has to, of course, deal with all this time. Once she gets the service, she cannot have any other stuff going on in her life. She can't travel to see her grandchildren if they need her, because she'll lose the services she's gotten. So government services are not a panacea. They can be helpful on for short-term things, but for long-term issues, it gets sticky because you're dealing with the regulations involved. She's in the process of looking at getting some new computer training. The Department of Rehab has the facilities to train her better, but it means for 3 to 6 months out of her life, she can't travel to see her grandchildren if they need her. And that makes it hard. That's just one situation. So what has she chosen to do? She's going to try to coordinate some transportation help with friends so that she can pay for the services out of pocket, commercially. But she's lucky she can afford to do that. Not all disabled people have the income to do that. And this is an area where it's outside of church scope, but maybe a great visit teacher or other great ward members can say, hey, maybe we can help this person. Maybe something as simple as offering a ride can help somebody get the services they need through the government so that they can be helped. The church doesn't offer employment services for the disabled per se in the way that they need them. So this would be a great substitute, because there are some good things out there. There are some good training programs out there, but getting at them might be a little bit of a challenge for somebody that is disabled.
Those are great suggestions. One thing that I'll probably ask you to kind of close with, you've mentioned many times this idea of, you know, disabled people do not want to be pitied. And you made a really good comment earlier about there's a difference between pity and assistance.
Right.
And I think oftentimes a lot of this happens, I think, also with grief work and death and just anything that's difficult to talk about, mm-hmm. is that people kind of become paralyzed. It's like, well, I don't want to be offensive, and I'm so scared of being offensive that then I just don't do anything at all, you know? And so maybe you could spend a few minutes just kind of educating us in ways that, like, what are good things to say or not say? What's maybe some of the language that we can be using that, you know, that is appropriate? And, you know, how do we help each other work through our own biases, if that makes sense?
You know, that's a really great question. And it actually reminds me of an experience I had when I was 18. No, I was actually older than that. I had returned to California. I gained my sanity and attended Sonoma State. And the year before I did that, I spent time interning in a low vision blind program in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I worked with this young girl who happened to be LDS. And she was blind, but she was also physically, she had some deformities within her face. And people in the stake did not know how to deal with her at all. And my little brother was, or my younger brother, he's, my younger brother was one of those people. And he really didn't know what to say to her. And we'll call her, Lily. And Lily had, you know, she was a musician. She was this wonderful kid. And she was, you knew that she was going to go professional with, her musicianship. Well, my younger brother came home one night and said, "She's blind and she's ugly. I don't know what to say to her." And I blew up at him. I said, "How dare you call her that? How dare you treat her like that? You have a sister who is disabled. You know, how can you have that attitude?" And he broke down, and he was about 12 years old at this point, and he broke down, and he's, "I don't know what to say to her." And I, after I got a hold of myself, I sat him down and I said, "You know, you go up to her and you say, 'Hi, Lily. My name is Danielle. And I'd like to help you with that, or I'd like to get to know you.' You say what you say to somebody who has sight. You say what you say to somebody who can walk. You know, the children's songbook has a song in it now called 'I'll Walk With You.' I have a love-hate relationship with that song. I love it because it really tries to normalize disability. I hate it because church members really don't understand that it goes far beyond that. And that's what you do with somebody that's disabled. They're no different from you. They need the same love and friendship as anybody else. And I don't think I can normalize it more than that. That they're like you, they're like me. They want to be loved. They want to be understood. And if we really mean what we say as Christians, then we need to show them the same love and kindness just by taking their hand and saying, "I'm Gail. You can't see me, but if you need to feel my face, I'm okay with that. Or can I help move you somewhere so you don't have to wheel your chair? And by the way, I'm here if you need me." Just get involved. And I guess that's it. Just get involved with them as you would anybody else. And ask them what their special needs are. And they'll tell you. I have a 5-minute speech that I give to my new clients when I meet with them face to face. and it involves my vision and my hearing issues. And after that 5-minute speech, we move forward. We do what we need to do as two human beings working together. And sometimes they ask me issues about it, and sometimes they don't. But it's all about introducing yourself and finding out how you can help. And usually, if you're open to talking to people in that way and just asking them, what are your needs? They'll tell you. I guess that's the most tame I can make this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think oftentimes it is that just getting over the initial awkwardness and just starting the conversation, right? And I think
it is a
big piece of it, like you said, is the friendship piece. It's not
just
the helping piece. You know, a lot of times we're when you see somebody who can't easily open a door or who's wheeling themselves around or is struggling, there's that natural sense of stepping in and helping. Some people want that. Some people don't want that type of assistance. And then, but I think it's more than that. If you get to know them, you would know a little bit more about what their perspective is and what might be helpful to them in those types of situations. Yeah. So I really appreciate your time and coming on here. I like you, hope that these types of podcasts, you know, just start opening up discussions more than what we have had in our wards and stakes and just in the different areas where we serve and deal with one another. There's so many different, you know, disabilities that it's hard to kind of discuss them all in one fellow swoop, you know, because it's so different, I think, what people face, depending if it is, like I said, mental or intellectual or physical or visual, you know, there's just each one of those comes with its own set of, you know, just challenges and different aspects that need to be looked at.
Right. And that is exactly why I didn't bring up specific disabilities, is because it's huge.
Yeah. And I hope to, you know, as we further this discussion, we'll see what types of comments we get. And I'd love to bring you back on or other people with this type of expertise back on or on in general, just so that we can maybe start discussing more specific populations.
Right.
I know that I have a sister here in the Wichita area that is working very closely with the deaf community. She is deaf herself and, you know, just really doing some neat nonprofit work. And so kind of trying to tap into some of the resources that we have even within Mormonism around some of these issues, I think, would be very helpful. So I really appreciate your time and your expertise and being so frank and open with us about things that you feel strongly about. And I just thank you for being on.
Yeah. Well, I hope you have that sister on, because the deaf community is lively and there are so many nuances within the culture.
Yes, you know, like, I have invited her, so we'll see if I can strong arm her to get on.
I will definitely listen. Yeah, it's an amazing community, and you know, it's different than the visually impaired / deaf blind community, which are the two that I'm most familiar with. But yeah, I have her on. And my, you know, I would like to see if you could get a parent that has a good grip on autism. So people, here's a shout out. If some of you listeners or if any of you listeners, feel like you've dealt with autism, for instance, and other developmentally disabled issues, I would certainly like to talk to you, because I'd like to get a better handle on the issues around that. I know some things, and I have some experience with working with developmentally disabled people. I just like to engage in a dialogue with you. And we will put my blog site up here. We'll put that information on, I know. So you'll be able to contact me. But if you have that, it would be great to hear from you. I'd like to learn more.
That's great. Thank you, Gail, so much. I just thank you for your time, and we will definitely be in touch.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll. Hiding rock and treacherous shore. Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus, Savior, pilot me.
As a mother stills her child,
boisterous way,
obey thy will,
when thou sayest
to them, be still,
wondrous sovereign of the sea, Jesus, say.
Fear not, I